Call to order the Committee on Human Services today, Friday the 13th of March, 2009. And we will not be hearing the House Bill 2794. We're waiting for...
2413.
2413, because we're waiting for amendments on that. So if anybody has come for that, sorry, but we'll be hearing it at a later time. And I'm going to open up...
you don't have to open anything. We can just fine.
Senate Bill 162 is going to go... we had on consent calendar, and Representative Cowan, would you carry that, please, on the floor?
Sure.
Thank you.
Figure out what it is.
I don't foster homes... protecting DHS information.
Okay, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2794.
This bill requires that health benefit plans include coverage of the HPV virus vaccine for female beneficiaries 11 years of age and older.
Great. Senator Rosenbaum, I think you're coming up. Sarah Alston.
No, go ahead.
Did you want Catherine to come up at the same time, Senator?
I think that we'll have a panel of experts after us.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and it's great to be over on the House side. I am State Senator Diane Rosenbaum from Senate District 21 in Southeast and Northeast Portland and Milwaukee. And I'm very pleased today to lead off a hearing that we thank you very much for holding on House Bill 2794. And I'm also appearing today in my capacity as co-chair with the chair of this committee of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance. That's an organization that I think is familiar to most of you, that's existed for over 16 years here in the state capital, of advocates and legislators and experts who have put together a package of bills every session to promote women's health and well-being and the well-being of Oregon's families. And in fact, this bill is particularly meaningful because I think the very first bill that the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance was able to pass was the requirement to cover annual screenings, in other words, mammograms, annual women's health exams, and pap smears. And as you know, those are great preventive steps to screen for cancers early on and be able to treat them at the earliest possible stage. So the bill that we bring you this morning, we think, follows well in the tradition of preventive health care for women. House Bill 2794 is really a very simple bill. It requires coverage for all women who are 11 or older, who are covered by Oregon-regulated health plans for the human papillomavirus vaccine. Cervical cancer is something that is treatable but can be very, very lethal for women, and you're going to hear more from experts in a few minutes, but the statistics in Oregon are that there are approximately 111 new cases of cervical cancer and 41 deaths resulting from cervical cancer in Oregon every year. In fact, it's the 16th most common cancer among Oregon women. And until a few years ago, really the best thing that we could offer other than treatment once it was diagnosed was just early screening through pap smears and annual exams. But in 2006, a wonderful and fairly unprecedented event happened. That was that the Food and Drug Administration was able to approve for usage a vaccine that we now know can prevent the majority of cases of cervical cancer before they occur. It's a life-saving vaccine that goes after the virus, human papillomavirus, that causes the majority of cases of cervical cancer. So what this bill does is just require insurance plans to cover the three-shot series, and we have a good group of witnesses who will provide some expert testimony on how effective this can be and why it's a good thing. But I want to make a couple of things clear about what this bill does not do. It does not require anybody to get the series of shots that we're talking about. That may be something to be considered, but it certainly is not the approach taken by this bill. This bill is just saying that if a woman and her family decides that they want to get the series of shots and have the protection that they afford, that they will be able to get their insurance to cover it. So with me today is a young woman to tell you of how she was able to avail herself of this potentially life-saving preventive health care.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Both be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Allsbrooks, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2794, which, as the Senator has told you, will require insurance companies to provide coverage for the HPV vaccine for females 11 years of age and older. And so it's intended to expand coverage of this preventative and possibly life-saving vaccine. I myself have received the vaccine, and fortunately, my insurance company did provide coverage. When I learned about the vaccine, I knew immediately that I wanted to take full advantage of its benefits, and I was able to, and I know that there are many other girls and women out there who would take full advantage of it if they were able to, if their insurance companies were able to provide coverage. And so I think that this bill will set a standard and also streamline the process, and I would urge the committee to pass this bill forward with a do pass recommendation.
Thank you, Ms. Allsbrook. Any questions of either of these two witnesses?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. Senator, thank you for coming. And we started this conversation last session, a little different, but started the conversation. The question, how many insurance companies don't cover it today?
Unfortunately, we are not able to give you a good statistical answer to that question. We're still working on trying to collect that information. And no state agency, well, we'll be hearing from the health department shortly, and they may have some idea of what's going on in the private insurance market. But there is really no state agency that actually collects that information. So, to some extent, we can't tell you exactly how many insurance companies are covering the vaccine. So I guess the answer is, I don't know.
Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up, thank you. So the Medicaid or Oregon Health Plan covers it.
Yes, that's correct.
Regions covers it. I'm not sure about Pacific Source and LifeWise, but I think they cover it. I guess I'm just trying to find out who doesn't, because I think that's, you know, we have a series of mandate bills that we're going to be reviewing in the healthcare committee, and I think that would have been an appropriate place to consider all of them at one time. So I'm just really interested in who's not doing it.
Right, and I think as we can do more research and work with staff, we will try to get you that information, okay. Representative.
Any further questions? Thank you so much for coming to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Today. All right, now I will call Catherine Bradley, Dr. Paul Cislak. Am I pronouncing anywhere close?
I say Cislak.
Cislak? Hey. <ooh. laughs> And after this, we'll have John Coney and Kathy Oatley.
Go ahead.
Are you prepared to speak first, or is Catherine going to speak first?
I think Catherine was going to speak first.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Bradley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health. Dr. Paul Cislak, who is the medical director for Oregon's immunization program, is here with me today, and we're here to provide you with the public health perspective on House Bill 2794. Specifically, what we'd like to provide is a brief background on cervical cancer and HPV vaccine with Oregon specifics, and also to talk about what the Oregon immunization program has been doing over the last 2 years. As you know, in 2006, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the use of the HPV vaccine for females 9 to 26 years of age. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which is known as ACIP, and actually is a committee that Dr. Cislak sits on and is involved in making recommendations. This committee has recommended routine immunizations for females age 11 and 12 years old. There's a consideration for females as young as 9 and 10, and a catch-up schedule and recommendation for those 13 to 26. Currently, there is only one vaccine that is licensed by the FDA, and that is the HPV vaccine by Gardasil, which is manufactured by Merck. There is another vaccine that is in consideration currently and is being reviewed. routine immunization for young women against HPV should prevent approximately 70% of cervical cancers and 90% of genital warts. This is important that this is in combination with regular Pap tests, because there are other there are some forms of cervical cancer as well as other infections that women need to be monitored for. The vaccine is offered in three doses, approximately 2 months apart. The cost is about $130 per dose, and it's close to $400 for the entire series. This has had a significant impact in Oregon. As was noted earlier, from Oregon statistics in 2005, 111 women had developed invasive cervical cancer, and 41 women died of the disease in that year alone. Each year, it's estimated that around 23,000 adult women in our state have an abnormal Pap smear that is related to the HPV infection. We spend approximately $30 million a year in direct costs for abnormal Pap smears, genital warts, and cervical cancer. And in Oregon, it is the 16th most common cancer among women, and significantly in Latina women, it is the 4th most common cancer. Over the last 2 years, our immunization program has been very active with a large community collaborative of providers as well as representatives from a multicultural community to really develop a series of materials and education so that we can work well with helping parents in making these decisions as well as helping providers understand the importance of this. In your testimony, you have information about the work that we've done. You also have a packet in front of you, which is, I believe, the provider packet of materials that we've developed, and that packet is developed as a resource for providers and for families, and also addresses such issues of an emphasis on tribal clinics, serving Latina women, information both in Spanish, and several other bilingual educational resources. We have made sure that Medicaid clients are covered, 19 to 26, under the Oregon Health Plan. We've distributed over 90,000 doses to over 424 offices, and that's a value of over $12 million, which has come from federal dollars in just over 27 months. And this is funneled through our Vaccine for Children program so that all Medicaid clients and all children can be covered between the ages of 19 and 26, whether they're uninsured or underinsured. We've also worked across the public health division with all of our different programs to find ways to leverage this work. So, for example, we enrolled all of our family planning sites in the state as VFC providers. So we've worked very hard to expand access and information and education. The other thing that we did is we have begun forecasting for all females at 9 years of age, which is an important tool in our alert immunization registry, because that means that in any provider's office, that once a child is of nine, a girl is nine, that automatically the information would come up that this would be an immunization that would be due. This prompts the provider to have a conversation then with the family around this. In the fourth quarter of 2007, the rate of uptake was 21% in 11 to 18-year-olds. So that's one of the things we're able to do with our alert registry, is actually understand what the amount of vaccine has actually been administered. So at the end of 2007, we were at 21%. As of the third quarter of 2008, we were up to 32%. So Dr. Cieslak and I are available to speak to any questions you might have, and thank you very much for inviting us this morning.
Madam Chair.
I think I heard you say this, but it's early and I wasn't really following all of it. Did you say that this was already available for all women through your system?
Chair Tomei and Representative Freeman, we have made it accessible through the public health system and the Vaccine for Children so that young women who are underinsured or uninsured are able to receive it. Yes.
Great. Thank you.
Catherine, could you talk a little bit about why it's important to get this vaccine to females before they become sexually active?
Chair Tomei, if I'm more, I think I'd like to have Dr. Cieslak speak to that.
That's great.
Chair Tomei, for the record, I'm Dr. Paul Cieslak, manager of the Communicable Disease Program for the Public Health Division and medical director of the Immunization Program. Basically, the vaccine doesn't work once you've been infected with the strains that the vaccine is meant to protect against. In other words, it doesn't treat infection, it just prevents infection. Cervical cancer typically ensues after about 20 years of being infected with a carcinogenic strain of which type 16 and 18 are the most common ones. So what you want to do is vaccinate people before they've been exposed to type 16 or 18 human papillomavirus. And the best way to do that is to vaccinate people before the onset of sexual activity.
Great. I didn't mean to interrupt whatever else you were going to be saying, so please, if you had other testimony, feel free to go ahead.
Oh, I don't have any testimony. I'm basically just here to answer questions about the disease and the vaccine.
Representative Maurer.
Yes, thank you. The question is the difference between Gardasil and Cervarix. Is it how it's pronounced?
Cervarix.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, Gardasil protects against four types of human papillomavirus, 16 and 18, which are the two of the major cancer-causing types, and 6 and 11, which cause 90% of genital warts. Cervarix, which hasn't been licensed yet, but we're sort of expecting it any day, does not protect against genital warts. It is only 16 and 18, the cancer-causing types.
Okay.
Any further questions? It seems to me that it's unusual for us to have a vaccine that prevents against cancer. Are there any other vaccines that protect against cancer?
Yes, Madam Chair. The hepatitis B vaccine, which protects us against hepatitis B, can also prevent cancer because, believe it or not, when I was in med school anyway, hepatoma, primary cancer of the liver, was the most common cancer worldwide. Why is that? It's because much of the world was infected with hepatitis B virus. It hasn't been that big a problem in the United States, but nevertheless, by preventing hepatitis B, you're also preventing some fraction of liver cancers. So that was the only other one to my knowledge, and this is the second one, and cervical cancer is a much bigger problem in the United States than liver cancer has ever been.
Right. So this is a pretty miraculous breakthrough mm-hmm. for young women, that they can prevent cancer that we might not see for 20, 25 years after they become sexually active. Is that
I think it's a wonderful development. I will say, cervical cancer is 100% preventable if you get pap smears regularly. So one of the most important things we need to do is to make sure that group of women who are least likely to get pap smears get vaccinated, and that's how we'll have the best effect with this vaccine.
Following up on that line of thinking, and that's one of the reasons why low-income women, why it's so important to be able to give them this vaccine, if in the future they might be less likely to have yearly pap smears.
Chair Tomoe, that's right on. I do want to caution that nobody is recommending that even if you get this vaccine that you stop getting pap smears,
right,
because it only prevents 70%. The two strains that cause 70% of cervical cancers, there's still the other 30% lurking out there. But nevertheless, you can prevent 70% of them with the vaccine.
Right.
So
any further questions? Representative Maurer.
From the first witnesses, so who's not covering this?
Chair Tomei and Representative Maurer, we don't actually have specifics about who is not covered at this time. We know the major health plans that we're aware of do cover. We made sure that we've got coverage under Medicaid and OHP, and then we've got access through the public health system when the vaccine for children. I think that probably the largest group that is the unknowns are from the ERISA plans, which also are generally not covered by state mandates either. So our assumption is there's a fair amount of variability around that.
So, Madam Chair, follow up. So that leads to the crux. If it's not covered by the ERISA plans, which are an ERISA plan is a federal law that exempts companies like that are self-insured, like Intel and Nike and Portland Public School Trust, those would not be covered under this. So we have a huge number of Oregonians that would be completely unaffected by the passage of this bill. So it gets back to, what is the need for this particular piece of legislation? Are we doing it because we're trying to promote the vaccination, which I'd have no problem supporting? Mm-hmm. The question is, why do we need this piece of legislation?
Chair Tomei and Representative Maurer, We are actually not here speaking either for or against the bill. We really were trying to predominantly provide information about the HPV vaccine. We do recognize that it's a significant issue with our ERISA population. You know, I don't have a really specific response in regards to that.
If I may, yes, Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, about half of the babies born in Oregon are VFC eligible, so they're covered by the VFC plans. Most of the rest, vaccines for children, federal entitlement. My understanding is that about 43% are covered by insurance plans, and that leaves about 7% who are uncovered, who are completely uncovered, and you know they don't have insurance and they're not VFC eligible. My understanding is that of the ones who are covered by non-ERISA insurance plans, typically the insurance companies fall in line with the ACIP recommendations and cover them. So I don't know specifically regarding this vaccine, but for most of the vaccines, they tend to cover what ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, recommends.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Interesting point.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming to Salem to testify with us. Now I'll call John Connie and Kathy Oatley. Next up will be Alice Bartelt and Melissa Blakely. Do I have any others? Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Coney. I live in Northeast Portland, and I'm here to support the bill, House Bill 2794. And my reason for testifying to you this morning is I want to share what it's like for a family to go through treatment of cervical cancer. In hopes that this committee will have an enhanced appreciation and an enhanced education for the tremendous financial and emotional costs of treating this disease, also in hopes that it provides some value supporting a measure like this which can prevent it. In January of 2008, my wife Jennifer, who was then 38 years old, was diagnosed with stage 4-B cervical cancer. And I do want to state clearly for the record, her case was actually in that 30% that was not a result of HPV. Nonetheless, I think my point here is walking you through what the treatment is like, is that if there is some preventive measures that can be taken to prevent other families from having to go through what we've gone through, I think it's well worth it. So I'll spare you all the gory details of treatment, but after the first couple of initial surgeries, she faced 6 weeks of daily radiation treatment and weekly chemotherapy. After that first phase of treatment, she had six additional rounds of chemotherapy. This was the kitchen sink strategy. They threw everything in the book at her. I don't know if you've ever seen a loved one hooked up to a bottle of poison, which chemotherapy essentially is, and get pumped into their system. But it's a very traumatic and trying experience. She was at first was able to live a normal life. As things went on, she got progressively weaker. She lost her hair. Her body weight got precipitously low. She was at risk for dangerous infections. She had to have several blood transfusions over the course of last spring and last summer. And there are several secondary health problems that can come up as a result of radiation treatment in particular. And sure enough, she got hit with a severe intestinal blockage in the fall. And she had to, it required a couple of hospital stays. She eventually had to go into the hospital a third time for 2 weeks and have another major surgery to correct it. She's doing okay now, but we're in that 5-year window where we don't know what's gonna happen next. She's getting her strength back. I also want to touch, so that's kind of a medical overview of what someone goes through treating this disease. The financial costs, I can tell you, I saw some of the invoices come across. We have double health insurance. We both work. She works for the state of Oregon. I work for Metro, the regional government in Portland. We were double insured, and the costs were in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. It was absolutely astounding. And we were lucky because we had double coverage. In fact, some of the procedures, some of the treatments were covered by one insurance company but not by the other, and vice versa. We were able to, with a patchwork, to put those things together. Even with that, this ordeal has cost us thousands of dollars out of pocket for things that were not covered. In terms of lost wages, we both, she was unable to work for months at a time. I took months off to care for her. Our extended family, our immediate family, it was very traumatic for them. Coworkers as well. We had a lot of friends and coworkers who were picking up the slack for us, both at work when she was gone and when I was gone. It was very difficult for them. So there's a large ripple effect to this. So I wanted to share this with you. And again, I want to be clear that while her case was not an HPV case, I can't imagine what it would be like for a family that does not have health insurance, or a self-employed person, somebody who doesn't work for a large employer where they can pick up the slack. Had we not been in the situation we were, we would have been ruined financially, no question about it. So I wanted to share this overview with you because it's whether a cervical cancer case is caused by HPV or some other cell irregularity. Once it's cancer, and it is not a walk in the park. And having seen the massive financial outlays that our insurance companies had to make, that we had to make as a family, that our other friends and family had to make, I can't imagine that that the upfront costs of treating this by insurance companies would not more than pay for themselves in terms of not having to go through the expense of treating this disease, in addition to having a better health outcome. So thank you for your time. I hope this testimony helps and paint the picture for you of what it's like to go through this. And if there's a preventative measure that can be taken, I am all for it. So thank you.
Thank you very much for telling us your story. Appreciate you coming to the committee.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and committee members. My name is Kathy Otley. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2794. I ask you to support this bill because it's a preventative safety measure. This vaccine can capture and cure a virus early on before it has a chance to grow and wreak havoc on bodies. Capturing a disease before it can grow is similar to screenings such as mammograms and colorectal screenings. Getting screened early on is also a preventative safety measure, and that's where my story comes in. 11 years ago, my father died of cancer, and I became part of what's known as Relay for Life. The American Cancer Society has a network of volunteers who raise funds and educate and do advocacy work so that people are educated and there are laws and things that can help us eliminate cancer. That is our number one goal. So as I walked around a track here in Salem, where I've lived for the last 20-some years, I heard someone say that 49% of the people survive cancer. And I thought that was terrible because that means 51% don't. And in the last 11 years that I have been involved in the Relay for Life, the statistics have changed drastically. All cancer survived, total 5-year survival, we're at 65% survival rate. So I know in the last 11 years what has happened in our world because people are out there with preventative measures, finding our miracle vaccine, finding other cures for cancer. Part of Relay means that we celebrate the life of those who have survived. And so I stood on the outside of that track for 7 years applauding all those survivors. We try to find them and celebrate their lives. And never in my wildest dreams did I think that the next year I'd be walking the track myself, because I was diagnosed, treated, and cured of cancer in 21 days. And I was able to have that happen for a lot of the reasons why we're talking about things today. It's that preventative side. Because I was walking a track, I received some really great information from the American Cancer Society. It talked about, skin cancer and where you grew up and what your heritage is. And if you kind of answered yes or no to the majority of the questions, you should really go in for some screenings. So I answered a lot of yes questions. I was born and raised in Eastern Oregon long before they had sunscreen. had those horrible childhood sunburns. So I decided I'd start screening. In the third year of my screening, my doctor found cancer. And he didn't call me and tell me, you have cancer. A lot of us, I know, hate that statement. I got told, you have melanoma. And having worked in the healthcare industry for over 40 years, I knew exactly what that diagnosis meant. But because my doctor had a new, he had an instrument that could detect melanoma earlier, it was able to actually find it in its earliest stages, I was not at high a risk. I had an insurance company that paid for me to go in and have my screenings done. It also was going to pay for me to be treated. So I never lost a day at work. I went in at 4:30 on an afternoon and had a resection. I don't know if you're familiar with how you cure melanoma, but you simply have to cut it off the body. You have to go down far enough and out far enough until you get a clean margin and there are no cells, and then you got that part of melanoma. So I did, and 14 days later I got the PATH report, and I was cured. I still have to go in. I still have to be screened every year to make sure there isn't another part of my body where there is a cell growing that could potentially kill me. So early detection, early cure is what I'm all about. I am living proof as a cancer survivor that when we do have available to us access to care and we can get our screenings and be educated and we have our medical community with the most current, best tools they could possibly have, we are granting quality of life to millions of Americans here in and also around the world. We can save the lives of so many people. We do not have to die from cancer. Where I work, there's only about 90 employees, but a fellow employee 2 years ago was diagnosed with melanoma. Well, she wasn't diagnosed, treated, and cured in 21 days. She's still battling her disease. She wasn't diagnosed early enough. It had metastasized. She's had some complications. She's still alive. She's still fighting. But every one of us can have a different road depending on how early we are diagnosed. On January 28th of this year, I was involved in a celebration of Smoke-Free Oregon because we know what that law did for us when it came to trying to prevent lung cancer. On that day, January 28th, my friend Anna, who I worked with, died. She had cervical cancer. She was 44 years old. Anytime women are faced with the ability to prevent a debilitating disease, either through screening or vaccine, we must take it. I'm living proof of that. I'm not lying in a hospital somewhere. I'm living an active life, and I'm fighting cancer every step of the way. If I had not been diagnosed through a preventative measure, who knows what would happen and where my life would be today. I know my grandson would be really upset if I wasn't out there working with him to prevent further issues regarding cancer. This vaccine not only catches the HP virus, it wipes it out before harm can start. We as women should be allowed that choice. That is why I ask you please to support this bill.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us today, and we wish you the best of luck in continuing your battle and success. Give your wife our best, and
thank you.
Good luck on her success. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Is there anyone else here who wishes to speak on this bill?
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Alice Bartelt and Melissa Blakely?
Blakely.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. I'm speaking today as chair of the affiliate board of NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon. NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon's mission is focused on preventing unintended pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases, as well as protecting women's health and ensuring that they have access to comprehensive reproductive health care. And we support HB 2794. HVP is the most common sexually transmitted infection in the United States. Over half of all sexually active men and women have HPV at some point in their lives. Today, insurance companies are not required to cover this preventative vaccine, although the vaccine can give results that will last a lifetime, give prevention that will last a lifetime. The result is that families wishing to protect their daughters if they don't have insurance will have to pay hundreds of dollars out of pocket for routine treatment. In this economy, that is an added expense many of families cannot afford. This committee and the legislature has the opportunity to ensure that women and girls will be protected against cervical cancer. By requiring health insurance to cover this preventive vaccine, we will safeguard the health of women and girls against HVP and cervical cancer. So we ask for your support for this bill.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Melissa Baugley. I'm 18 years old and a senior at Beaverton High School. I'm here today to share my perspective on the HPV vaccine coverage that is included in House Bill 2794. I know that many adults don't like to think about kids, especially their children, becoming sexually active, and some may raise the specter of encouraging sexual activity to stop families from having their daughters vaccinated against HPV. I sincerely hope you won't fall into that trap. Right now, there is a lot of confusion in medical offices about which insurance companies cover the vaccine and which don't. When I asked my mom about the vaccine and we started looking into it, it wasn't easy to find out if my insurance company would cover it. My mom and I went to my pediatrician's office, and since we didn't have proof that the insurance would pay for it, they made us pay $180 up front just for the first of three shots. However, when I went back to get the second shot without my mom, they wanted me to pay up front again, even though we had been reimbursed for the first shot. With my insurance at other medical offices, we don't have to pay up front. The office will bill our family first before asking us to pay up front. I am lucky that I come from a family that both realize the importance of me receiving this vaccine and have the ability to pay for it up front when the pediatrician's office wouldn't bill us first. But there are many families in Oregon that do not have these same conditions. The current healthcare system often doesn't focus on disease prevention. If girls were able to get this vaccine, over time it will lower healthcare costs because it will decrease the cases of cervical cancer. Without all insurance companies covering this vaccine, families will be put in the position of making difficult decisions, resulting in many girls not getting the health care that they need and deserve. Thank you for the opportunity for having me testify here today.
Thank you for coming before us today. Any quick questions of this panel? No. Great. Thank you so much for coming. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak on this? All right. I'll be closing the public.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm just wondering, I mean, because this is an insurance mandate, it certainly seems that we would have the insurance division to answer the simple question, who's not covering this vaccine?
We will find that information for you before the next meeting, before the next hearing on this bill. Thank you very much. All right. We'll close the public hearing on 2794. And
that's not the insurance company.
Open up the public hearing on 2726.
House Bill 2726 requires that chain restaurants with 10 or more affiliated restaurants make nutritional information regarding their menu items available to the public after point of sale.
Thank you. Representative Pelican, oh, she is right here.
Actually,
Good morning, colleagues.
Good morning.
It's nice to see you this morning. I am Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you for hearing this bill this morning. We have a little slideshow for your morning viewing pleasure about House Bill 2726, which is a tool that would provide valuable nutrition information for consumers at point of sale in chain restaurants. You will be receiving some written testimony from me with some copy of this as well as a newspaper article, which will be sent around in a moment, but there's a little quiz, so we haven't handed it out yet. This bill is about helping people make healthier choices, and if we want to tell people to take personal responsibility for their health and well-being, it's really important to give them the tools to do that. A lot of folks eat out. This is about providing consumer information in those restaurants where they eat, and let's start off with the first slide here. So this is Subway. It doesn't say that, but I'm sure you recognize the product. Probably from New York City, they've had menu labeling for more about a year now. And actually, my favorite sandwich at Subway is the Italian BMT. And so I just want to point out, I think pictures are really important when discussing this issue to see what this would mean for folks in the restaurants. So you see the Italian BMT at $3.69. For 450 calories for that sandwich. Now, the spicy Italian, which is 40 cents cheaper, has 30 more calories. And if you really want to have something with less calories for the same price, you could choose a Subway meal for 70 less calories. So the point here is that in context, with price, with calories side by side, people are going to be able to make more informed choices by having this kind of information. And like I said, this is about giving consumers what they want, which is this kind of information. So let's take our quiz. Which item at Pizza Hut has the fewest calories? The three cheese breadsticks, the four hot wings with blue cheese dipping sauce, a personal pan pizza with pepperoni, or two slices of large pepperoni pan pizza? Seems like an easy quiz. Let's go to the next slide. So those hot wings with the dipping sauce, fewest calories. I don't know. I'm not going to ask you to show hands which one thought that was the right answer.
I don't like any of them.
But, you know, I think many of you might have got this because that seems like a reasonable set of things. You could probably make some assumptions which one's healthier in terms of fewer calories. So let's go to the next quiz. Which item at Dunkin' Donuts, and many of you know I love donuts, has the fewest calories? The sesame bagel with cream cheese, the two jelly-filled donuts, the banana walnut muffin, or that medium 24-ounce strawberry banana smoothie?
Madam Chair, choose C.
No.
I'll give you a moment. Okay, next slide. It's those jelly-filled donuts.
Not donuts.
Which for those of us who love donuts, not a bad thing.
The trooper missed that one.
Many of you might have thought the smoothie has fruit in it. One of the higher calorie items. You probably didn't choose the cream cheese. You probably figured that had more calories. But I bet many of you did not believe the jelly-filled donuts would have the fewer calories.
Well, I knew the muffins.
So calories vary widely, and what we're talking about in this bill, again, is providing the calorie information next to the price so people can make informed decisions. What's interesting about this slide is the range of drinks at Starbucks for their grande-sized beverages. You know, anywhere from, you've got six drinks here, 50 calories to 500 calories. I'm sure most folks have no idea what the calorie content of these drinks are. So if we pass this bill, we'd have this kind of information at point of sale for folks. And it's really important for people to be able to see that information before they buy. Two more examples very quickly here. Back at Starbucks. Again, which is the best choice? We have the banana nut loaf at 460 calories for $1.85, or a rainbow cookie at 420 calories at $1.75. Very similar in price. But I bet many would have thought I should eat the nut loaf because that would seem healthier. It does have bananas in it. But you might want the cookie instead. But what is important here is people having that choice. I might still choose a banana nut loaf because I like that better, but I will know that maybe next time I should choose something with a little fewer calories. In New York City, like I said, they've had it for about a year now. They've had menu labeling. The early research is encouraging. People who see the information eat 52 fewer calories on average.
And research shows us that even reducing your caloric intake during the day by 100 calories could help people lose weight and fight the obesity epidemic here in our country. Other research about existing nutrition information offered in other formats, for example, brochures, posters, things like that, trainliners, is less encouraging. One study, an observational study, said or showed that out of 4,300 customers going into four chain restaurants, only six people out of 4,300 people accessed the posters or brochures. So again, this is about the information, but where the information is available. So what does House Bill 2626 do? It's going to provide that nutrition information before a purchase is made. We have a slide here showing some kids' menus, and you can see there, what's interesting, the one that caught my eye was the Shirley Temple at 240 calories for $1.49 versus the milk at $1.92 for slightly, 20 cents more. Again, parents, this is really important for parents who are making choices for their kids. I'm not sure if you can see that closely. And in the bottom slide, or the bottom photo is breakfast wraps showing the spinach feta wrap at 240 calories versus the bacon avocado wrap at 380 calories. Both at the same price. So again, I think people would be very surprised to see side-by-side comparisons of the items that they're considering purchasing. The bill would apply to chain restaurants, currently defined in the bill as 10 or more outlets nationally. We will probably be amending this. We will be amending this to match Multnomah County's, which is actually 15 outlets nationally, not the 10. So we'll be going to the 15 to match what Multnomah County is doing. And you'll be hearing from Commissioner Kogan from the county about what they're doing. It'll apply to standard menu items. There's a time frame, so we're not including those, monthly or seasonal specials. And the calories would be on menu boards or food tags close to where the item is in so people can make those choices. Of the 100, and this information is in my testimony, of the 181 chains in Oregon, 132 will have to follow Multnomah County's rules that went into effect yesterday. Of the remaining 49 chains outside of Multnomah County, 21 more are covered by labeling requirements in New York City or in King County up in Seattle. This bill would equalize the current competitive difference across county lines and chain locations, making it easier for restaurants to be in compliance. We're talking about calories on the menu, not everything under the sun, because that would be very complicated for folks, as well as a design nightmare. I am providing for you an article from the Oregonian that talks about the importance of calories. They did a large national study looking at different types of diets, low carb, low fat, all those. The common denominator of what was best for people was to reduce the number of calories, regardless of the type or diet you were on. So the idea is calories, not other information on the menu or menu boards. Chain restaurants, we're told, change their menus 2-3 times a year, so we believe this is information that could be easily added, depending on the timeline established in the bill. And many of the national chains, if not all of them, have this information already, whether on their websites or on brochures or posters. This information is readily available. We're not asking for some odd new analysis to be conducted. And just to be clear, we will have amendments with this bill. I've had several conversations with the Oregon Restaurant Association about trying to come up with some consensus around this bill. You'll be hearing from them today. For example, they would like to see some language about no private right of action on the bill in terms of being able to sue the restaurants. I think that's a reasonable thing to add to the bill. This isn't about a gotcha on the restaurants. This is about providing consumer information. In the next slide here, I was surprised when I saw this. There are drive-thrus in New York City. This is a drive-thru menu. And our bill would include the information on drive-thrus. About half the money spent at fast food restaurants is purchased through drive-thrus. So it's a very important point for information at purchases in fast food chain restaurants. Polling shows that 69% of Oregonians support menu labeling in chain restaurants. And I underline menu labeling here because that's what was asked and not information somewhere else in the store, in the restaurant. Menu labeling the menu. So I think that shows that there are a lot of folks very interested in seeing this information.
And lastly, I'd like to just speak about the availability of this information already. So this is a slide showing a gentleman trying to read a very, very tiny poster on nutritional information. And I brought some examples of how some of the restaurants are providing this information now. This is from this is a tray liner. Often you'll hear that the industry says, we give that information, it's on tray liners. I don't know about you, I usually make a mess on my tray, so I don't know if I'd actually look at the tray liner. But if you did, if you look at, this is Burgerville, and there's a small message in the corner that says, if you want nutritional information, turn over. Well, first of all, you have to know to turn over. And then if those of you who might be, like me, having some issues with their vision, this is pretty tiny print and very complicated. Again, we're simplifying it, calories where you can see it in large font next to the price. Here's one from McDonald's. Again, small corner. Says, turn it over if you're interested. This has, you know, this doesn't give any indication that there's information on the back. Again, much smaller, more information, and we would like additional information available for folks. But at the end of the day, when you're in a hurry, and that's why you go to fast food restaurants, you want to see that calorie where you can see it right away. And then this is from Starbucks. They do have a brochure, but again, small font, lots of information, maybe not the easiest thing for the average consumer. I'd like to just share with you briefly my experience. I'm eating a lot in Salem these days. I was at the Olive Garden the other night, which would be covered by this bill. And they have a nice menu. They indicate some healthier items and things you can do to eat healthier on their menu, which is very nice. And then it says, if you want additional nutrition information, ask your server. So I asked my server. And she's very nice, young woman. She said, well, you can check the website. That has the most current information. Well, I suppose I could have pulled out my phone and looked up the website and before I decided that I really wanted the cheese sticks and the soup. But I didn't. And then it also said ask for written information. And she said, oh, well, I think we have it somewhere. I'll go look. Never came back, never provided the information. And I'm not faulting the server. I just think it indicates the challenges of taking something that's off the menu and expecting people to get that information easily. Talked about the tray liners. What's interesting about the tray liners is, you know, our bill is talking about point of sale versus point of guilt. You know, it's nice that, after you're sitting there eating your fries and, oh, wow, that was really, that's point of guilt. That's not really helping folks. And they might change it next time they come through if they remember it. So I want to wrap up and give time for other testifiers, but like I said, I have additional information in my testimony. I hope you'll support this bill. This is a common sense approach to providing the type of information that we can help Oregonians make healthier choices when they're eating out. It doesn't solve the entire problem of obesity, and I would never claim that it does. I think it's a very challenging epidemic. But we can't get started unless we start providing this kind of information. We need a multifaceted approach to this problem. Here's one way to start. It's easy. It's useful, and people are really interested in having it. So I hope you can support this bill. And with that, I'll take questions or make room for the other folks.
Any questions? Representative Loon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Rep. I almost said Tomei. Kotek. I'm curious. I have two things. What the question was asked in the poll.
I will get you that information.
Okay.
That was a poll conducted on behalf of, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Boone, on behalf of Northwest Health Foundation, and we could get you the actual question.
Okay.
Be happy to do
and
that.
Then follow up. Thank you. Personally, I think it's a good start in that sense, but I found a couple, in my opinion, my humble opinion, a couple of flaws in your testimony in terms of the fact that it was calories only that counted. I mean, I think it was much... If you had to have a choice of the cookie or the muffin, knowing how you make these things, cookies are made with hard, solid fat. Muffins are usually made with oil, et cetera. I think you get my drift. I would much rather have, if I were going to go through a fast food line, I would much rather have, in addition to the calories, the content of the fat, the cholesterol count, stuff like that, which to me then tells a true nutritional rather than just caloric. Because if you went on the examples that were given here and just ate those foods, I would think you'd be nutritionally deficient. I'm not trying to be contrary. I'm just saying that, and I don't usually eat at fast food restaurants except to drink the coffee. But I'm just trying to get a grip on how this is... nutritional labeling, nutritional information is getting past the caloric, and I get that you X number of calories, you know, you have to, the more you input, you have to output to not gain weight, et cetera. But I do think there should be something, if we're going to take this step, that gets into the nutritional value of the food.
Chair Tomei and Representative Boot, I think that's an excellent question. What the bill would also require is standardizing the type of information that would be available in a different format in the restaurants. So fat, sodium, trans fat. So people could be guaranteed that that information would be available. Again, a lot of that information is available maybe on websites or on posters, but at least in some format would be available in addition to that. We see this as an entryway to educate consumers because hopefully they're going to say, well, maybe I need to know more than just the calories and I can get the additional information. It's, you know, people are fast, on the go. It's a start. And again, you know, I have some purists out there who would like a lot more information posted on the menus, and it's just, you know, it's not realistic in terms of how you design those types of information in a restaurant. But I appreciate your question. It's a starting point. We need clearly a lot more public education. And I do have the question that was used in the poll for you from one of our handy supporters. It was, would you support a policy requiring fast food and restaurant chains to post the number of calories of food items on their menu boards?
Okay.
So it was very, it was a very clear
yes or no.
Yeah, okay. Yes or no. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kotak.
Good to see you.
Hey, thanks for bringing this bill forward. I'm curious, what do you do with the poor guy like me that doesn't want to see calories up there because they're afraid of what they're eating? And they're
be very afraid, Representative.
I mean, I like to eat a donut still every once in a while. And
that, you could eat that donut.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah.
That's
the best choice, therefore.
Just stay away from the muffins.
Right.
Well, I like banana muffins. You know, a little bit more. Follow up. Okay, thanks. And I appreciate where you're, you know, that your ears are open to listening to the different movement. It sounds like you are, anyways, for, you know, considering amendments and everything. Did you get a chance to work with the Restaurant Association prior to or in the development of this bill?
Well, we're in discussion, Madam Chair and Mr. Vice Chair. We are in consultation now. Because you know how the drafting stage is, we wanted, coming from Multnomah County, our goal was to get the Legislative Council what Multnomah County is doing because they've already started and they cover so many of the restaurants. That's where we started. But realizing that that, you know, may not be the perfect, you know, solution, particularly for the industry, saying that's our starting point, but we're open to discussion. So, and I know there is a bill that they have drafted, and we are doing side-by-side comparisons to figure out where's the common ground and what kind of things do we need to address. So, very open to doing that.
Okay, and follow-up. Okay, thank you. Have you had an opportunity to kind of see what Massachusetts has done with their process dealing with this? They do have a preemption, though, in that.
Madam Chair and Representative Olson, we have also received the Massachusetts proposal, the industry proposal, that, and we are also doing a side-by-side comparison on that as well. The only other state that has passed this is California, but they don't go into implementation until 2011 or 2012. It's a year or so out. But we're looking at all the proposals out there. There's, of course, on the horizon potential national legislation. But in the meantime, we want to make sure Oregonians in every corner of the state have access to that information, not just folks in Multnomah County.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any further questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Representative Kotek. Now we have Jeff Kogan, Kiernan Thompson, and Jordan Pinch. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Kogan, Multnomah County Commissioner for District 2, and I'm here this morning on behalf of my colleagues to encourage you to support House Bill 2726. As Representative Kotek mentioned, Multnomah County recently passed an ordinance substantially similar to House Bill 2726, and I wanted to share with you some of the process that we went through in passing this and some of the thoughts and actions we took. First of all, the reason that we addressed this is, as the local public health organization, we became aware, as no doubt you are as well, that our community and our state has been facing an epidemic in diabetes, heart disease, and other chronic diseases that are largely caused or at least significantly influenced by obesity. We asked our health department to convene a study to try and come up with reasonable responses to the situation. And the health department recommended, after doing a national search of best practices, that we should consider menu labeling on chain restaurants. At that point, we asked them to convene a broad stakeholder group to consider how this might work. That stakeholder group included representatives of the fast food industry, representatives specifically of the Oregon Restaurant Association, public health officials, and members of the Multnomah County Health Department. They worked for almost a year trying to figure out what a good menu labeling ordinance would look like, and frankly, was it a good idea? Representative Boone, in response to your issue regarding how much information should be on there, I should let you know, originally where the health department was going was requiring the menus to have calories, saturated fat, trans fat, carbohydrates, and sodium, and cholesterol. And, you know, I think that the intention was, and it always has been, that providing lots of information would be good for the consumers. But in response to concerns from the restaurant industry that basically said, this will destroy the integrity of our menus, we reconvened and, after thinking this through, decided that the best compromise and the most reasonable approach would be to put the single biggest contributor to obesity, which was calories, on the menu, but also to make it available at every restaurant, all the other information. So that on the point of sale, there will be calories, and there will then be information saying, if you need more information about these, just ask. It's going to be here in a ready-to-use format. I think that was an attempt to get the best possible good and also an attempt to do it in a way that minimized impact on the restaurants and allowed their menus to keep the integrity that they're trying to do, maintain their brands and maintain their way of getting their information around. They convened this, they brought this together, and about a year ago we passed an order at establishing the policy in Multnomah County that would say we're going to do menu labeling. At that point, we asked the health department to convene another process of rulemaking to develop the specific rules to implement this. Again, during this process, it was a very inclusive process. We had several public hearings. We consulted with specific restaurants and with the Restaurant Association, as well as with public health organizations. And again, we made some changes that were reflecting concerns of the restaurant industry. For example, originally, a pizza would have had to list how many calories were in the entire pizza. We were presented with the information that most people don't actually eat an entire pizza. Might be more reasonable to let them say how many are in a slice of pizza. We made that change. We also were originally going to have this take effect very quickly. The restaurant said it takes us time to make these changes. Although we were providing technical assistance, it's still the case, as Representative Kotek mentioned, that they change their menus on average 2 or 3 times a year. We wanted to give enough time that this could be done as part of the regular implementation of menu changes to minimize additional costs or burden on the restaurants. So we provided a grace period so that actually they haven't, although the law is currently in effect in Multnomah County, we are not enforcing it for another 9 months because we want it to be reasonable, work with the restaurant industry. Because of that, it passed unanimously at Multnomah County Commission. And the reason the commission was so enthusiastic about it is that we now have a track record in other parts of the country, New York, King County, but especially New York, that shows this works. It makes a significant difference in the choices people make. And as Representative Kotek's presentation showed, although we all know maybe fast food restaurants aren't the healthiest place to eat, we also all eat in them, and we don't necessarily know what the impacts are. There are significant differences. In our own county process, we had a little test that I took, and I was shocked to discover that in one of our local restaurants, the chicken sandwich had twice as many calories as the hamburger. And again, it's not saying that we're not telling people you shouldn't eat the chicken sandwich, you shouldn't eat the hamburger. That's not what this is about. It's not a nanny state proposal that says, do this, don't do that. We're from the government and we know best. It's not that. What this is about is saying we want you as consumers, as citizens, to have the information available that allows you to make the choices that work for you. Representative Olson, we're not telling you not to eat your donuts.
This, you know, I love this committee, but this is the most depressing committee meeting.
But I really do believe that the reason that 69% of Oregonians support this is because they want to be able to make choices for themselves, and this is a very effective way for us to give folks information that allows them to make reasonable choices that make a difference in their lives. Again, we have now implemented it. We have now gotten feedback. Overwhelmingly, people in our community are happy to have this information. It's begun to be real, too. It's nice to see that there are pictures from New York City that can help you, but come on down to Multnomah County. We have restaurants right now that have implemented this. The Noah's Bagel chain did it very quickly. Met with them a couple weeks ago. The feedback they've gotten has been terrific. I encourage you to come to Multnomah County, eat a bagel, see what this looks like in person.
Tourism department.
These are tough times, whatever we can do for our time. But, you know, I also want to just take a note to say, I know that there are some other proposals out there. One of the key there's two things about this proposal that I really want to emphasize. The point of purchase information is critical. Research shows that's where people actually make their decisions, and that's what will make a difference. And then finally, I would encourage you not to support a bill that preempts local governments from acting. Local governments are the laboratories of experimentation in our community. Multnomah County, working with our community for 2 years, came up with this action. I think it's helped guide the state in its decisions, and I think it's a positive thing for our community to allow local communities to experiment. I think it's terrific, and I've always said from the moment we begun, for the state to act. We want to encourage the state to act, but I don't think you should discourage local communities from experimenting and from working. I also want to share with you another piece of information, personal information. Before I got involved in politics, I ran a small food business for 6 years. I understand the challenges of running a small business, and I understand that sometimes as a business person, you get upset with the government for telling you what to do. But that background and that knowledge was one of the reasons that we were so concerned in our process with listening to what the restaurant industry had to say, with trying to craft a proposal that was a reasonable balance between the needs of the people in our community to have information and the needs of our small businesses to try to continue and to thrive. And this is a tough time in our economy, but this is a proposal that is not going to propose an undue burden on business, but will provide significant benefits for folks in this community. So I would encourage you to support it. Thank you for giving me a chance to speak with you this morning.
Thank you so much for coming and telling us your story. Any questions, Mr.
Just one question, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Jeff, I appreciate that. And thanks for the... Wow. Emotionally traumatized here. So a member from the Restaurant Association was on board at your table?
Yes.
Through this whole discussion as you were preparing for that?
Yes.
Okay.
The stakeholder group included members, individual restaurants as well as the Restaurant Association.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you for having me.
So whoever would like to be next?
Hello. My name is Karen Bryan, and I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2726. I think that having calories listed with the prices of food is a very good idea. So let me see how many calories I am eating. If you've already had a lot of calories for the day, I might choose a lower calorie option on the menu. I'm 13 years old, and I play baseball and basketball. In the past, I've had to watch my weight in order to carry the football and while I was quarterbacking. And if this law was, it would have definitely helped. I live in Northeast Portland, and I go to Rosewood Heights Middle School. On the weekends, I live in Oregon City, but even though there would be menu labeling at the restaurants near my house in Portland, I would also like it, the menu labeling in Oregon City. There will be a good law. This will be a good law to help people manage their diet. I ask you to pass House Bill 2726.
Thank you so much. Any questions of this young man? Thank you for coming today. You did a nice job. I hope you're going to stay long enough to get a tour through the Capitol, maybe even go up to see the Gold Man. It'd be a beautiful day to go up there. You'd probably get a good view. Thank you for coming.
Did a great job. Go ahead. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Jordan Pinch, and I'm a senior at Portland State University in the Health Studies program. As seniors, we are required to take a capstone class, which incorporates a community-based learning opportunity. And I did mine in marketing and public health this past quarter. Our class project was to evaluate how consistently and clearly nutrition information is presented to customers at various restaurants throughout the Tri-County area. To do that, all 15 students visited 96 outlets of 7 different chains that are operating in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. What we found was very discouraging. The biggest problem we had was that when we walked into the establishments, we couldn't figure out where to go to get the information. The few instances where we could actually find the information, it was in bizarre places, such as on the back of a placemat laid on a tray or on a poster hung by the bathrooms or the soda machines. When we asked the staff where we could find the information, they seemed to get annoyed. Some of the employees were rude and others seemed pretty helpless. What we realized is that the staff didn't have the information at hand, and often they had to get a manager to find it for them. Most of the time, they ended up telling us just to check out their website. And in one instance, a student was handed a small piece of paper with a phone number and told that he could call to get the nutritional value for one meal, which was, I suppose, sort of like a hotline for one meal. Ultimately, our class was extremely frustrated by the vast inconsistency of nutrition information in the fast food, sit-down, and drive-through establishments that we visited. We ended up wondering whether simply providing the nutrition information in a legible manner on the menu or menu boards wouldn't just save time, money, and energy for all involved. As a public health student and aspiring educator, I strive to be well-informed about health. In a couple of cases, I had difficulty finding nutrition information on the websites, and I certainly don't have time to call any hotlines before I go out to eat. People want to eat fast food because it is fast, and they don't want to have to call ahead of time. If a college-educated student in the health field cannot effectively find this type of information when looking for it, then it seems there is a problem. I urge you to vote yes to this bill and require calorie labeling at the point of decision-making for all Oregonians, college-educated or not. Thank you for this opportunity to share some of our findings with you.
Thank you. It seems that your material was written. If so, could you give a copy of it to our staff?
Yes.
And he will disseminate it to the committee.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Any questions of this witness? Representative
Actually, Denver. This is a question for the commissioner, if that's okay, Madam
sure.
Chair. Thank you. Say, Jeff. You know, one of the things that happens in some fast food restaurants is a tendency to try to get people to increase the size of what they're buying, you know, to supersize, right? And, you know, often that's done in a way that it's actually pretty affordable to get a much larger size as compared to the original size. But, of course, the calorie amount has increased dramatically. How does the Multnomah County practice deal with that, the subject of larger sizes or, you know, serving sizes? Is that laid out per item? Could you explain that?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Dembrough. It's a very good question. The way it would work is that each size would specifically list the amount of calories associated with that size. And that just also reminds me of one of the other maybe not obvious benefits of this. Yes, it's the case that you would see that the supersized fries have three times as many calories, for example, as a small, if that's really what it is. But what we've seen in New York and what we expect to see here as well is that when fast food restaurants are forced to provide the actual caloric information, they begin to reformulate their products and they begin to change their sizes. So I think we will find that, yes, first of all, you'll find out what it really is if you want to supersize that meal. But I think you'll also find that eventually, and with time, it's already started to happen in New York, you're less likely to see things that are quite so fattening on the menu. And that's also what's happened over the years with the packaging labeling that we've had with regular food from the grocery store. Trans fats are much less common than they used to be once they had to be disclosed. Formulations of foods have changed to make them slightly healthier, and I think that will happen with this as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the questions. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate you guys being here today. And this question is to the Commissioner. Some of the comments you just made were a little bit different than what Representative Kotek said. She said that the idea of this is to simply have the information available. You kind of spoke to how it changes what becomes available. And I'm curious as to what we're really trying to do here.
Madam Chair and Representative Freeman, what we are trying to do is have the information become available. What we've seen in the past is that when the information becomes available, manufacturers and producers sometimes change what's available to get rid of some of the, you know, if you think of a bell curve, some of the items on the far end of the curve may start to drop off. That's not the goal. We're not trying to get folks to stop serving quadruple cheeseburgers with bacon. I mean, that's fine if they do that. But we have seen in the past, it's been true in New York, it's also been true in that once disclosure is required, there are some changes that tend to be made to what's offered. That's not really what we're trying to get at. We're just trying to give people information. That's really the goal here.
Thank you.
You're welcome, sir.
Any further questions? Thank you all so much for coming.
Thanks
today.
For having us.
Appreciate it. We have 11 more people who have signed up. So if that's the case, we either have to shorten testimony or continue this public hearing. Representative Kotek, do you have any desire? Shall we shorten each person's testimony? Okay, so that everybody can be heard today. Okay, you've got it. So then it's going to be 2 minutes per person. Does that seem reasonable? All right. Amy Chapman, Terry Talfour, and Lori Trieger. And I'm going to have a... Would you do that for me?
Just make it a couple more minutes.
Let me figure out how to work this first. If you want to.
You have 2 minutes.
I got it.
Okay, so keep on going. And after this, we'll have Bill Perry, Kevin Bechtel, and Debbie Nagy Nero. Okay, go ahead.
I'll go ahead and start. Chairman Tomei and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Terry Tollifer, and I'm the director of Wasco Sherman Public Health Department. House Bill 2726 will serve our rural communities well. In public health, there's evidence that consumers make better informed, healthier choices when that information is available to them at the point of choice at that time. The concern in rural communities is that there's going to be an undue burden on business owners, restaurant owners. When we reviewed the restaurants that are currently operating in Wasco and Sherman counties, we believe that all of them that are fitting the definition of a chain in this bill also operate in Multnomah County and will fall under their ordinance. It would require no further expenditure for them to get the nutritional information. There is that potential cost for reprinting menus and menu boards, but we understand that this is currently done on a periodic basis. To reflect menu changes and price adjustments. So, thank you.
Thank you so much. That was very fast.
Madam Chairman and other representatives, Amy Chapman, Lincoln County, and I work in environmental health, and I'm here as an individual and to give you a snapshot of Lincoln County.
Welcome, Amy.
Hi, Jean. Lincoln County has about 15 or 20 different restaurant chains that would fall into this category, and of the actual facilities, there would be about 25 or 30 facilities that would be affected. Most of the chains fall under the have corporate offices that would have or probably already have the information that's being required of them, and it would require a change in their menu boards. There are a couple of chains that maybe might not fit under this, and I understand that the Oregon Dietetic Association would give them a hand in evaluating their menus. The other thing I'd like to say in Lincoln County is that there seems to be a growing awareness of the link between food and health. In the newspapers, I see weight loss, following weight loss in individuals. I notice that there's talk about Weight Watchers classes, and I know personal testimony of people who are very glad to see calories and information about the nutrition on menus in restaurants, particularly when they're part of these Weight Watcher classes. I just would like to say in Lincoln County, I think this would be welcome information by our residents.
Thank you for coming this way, both of you. Appreciate it. Why don't you just move that over there? Move the mic. There you go.
Good morning. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, thank you for holding this hearing on the important topic of chain restaurant menu labeling. For the record, my name is Lori Trieger, and I'm here from Eugene, Oregon, Lane County. I'm here today wearing three hats. The first is as executive director of ELCHE, which is the Lane Coalition for Healthy Active Youth. ELCHE is a private nonprofit, and our mission is to prevent childhood obesity and related diseases in Lane County, Oregon. ELCHE works collaboratively with a wide range of concerned individuals, organizations, and institutions. Since October of 2008, ELCHE has been at the forefront of efforts to enact a local policy order for Lane County similar to the one you're hearing today at the statewide level. I have dozens of endorsements for a local policy from a diversity of individuals, agencies, and interests, including endorsement from the Lane County Medical Society, which represents 95% of all physicians in Lane County. There's clear constituent will for menu labeling in Lane County, which extends out to the rural parts of our county. With a population of just over 343,000, nearly half of that population lives outside the Eugene-Springfield metropolitan region, including unincorporated areas and several rural communities such as Cottage Grove and Oak Ridge. I said that I come before you wearing three hats today. The second hat is as a parent. Our family's on pretty stable ground these days, but that wasn't always so. When our first child was born, which was many years ago now, we relied on food stamps and the WIC program to help meet our food and nutritional needs as a family. It wasn't always easy, but I was committed to providing my family with wholesome meals, and still am today. What was often most challenging for me was dining out and shopping on a limited budget. I'm an avid label reader, and I worked hard to budget both our money and our caloric intake. I could balance choices depending on what the bottom line looked like on our checkbook, as well as, is this a good day to treat ourselves to something maybe a little more indulgent and we'll make it up later? How would I know how to make that decision? With my checkbook, it's obvious. I've got the numbers right there in front of me. With the caloric content and other nutritional information, not so simple.
15 seconds.
I have observed, I'm guessing it has not escaped your notice either, that often the most readily available, accessible, and affordable foods in many communities is those offered by chain restaurants. You might be hard-pressed to find a full-service grocery, particularly in many of our outlying communities in this state, but you can be pretty much guaranteed there's a chain restaurant nearby. And in closing, I'll don my third hat, which is that for 12 years I worked in the restaurant and food services industry on both East Coast and West Coast, from sit-down establishments to counter-service establishments. And the one concept that was consistent in every place I worked was the basic tenet that says the customer is always right. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, thank you for your time this morning for honoring what customers all over Oregon want, which is to see calories posted on menus and menu boards in chain restaurants. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Any quick questions of anyone on this panel? Thank you so much for coming this way today. Appreciate it. So now we have Bill Perry, Kevin Bechtel, Debbie, and you have to help pronounce your name, Debbie. And after this, Jerry Scott, Susan Connolly, and Mark Watkins. We actually have a few people that work for us
today. Ready, Madam Chair?
Please.
For the record, Bill Perry, Oregon Restaurant Association. Thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. I'll try to rush through this as fast as possible. We have a bill we've been working with Rep. Schaffler and Rep. Cameron on, 2982, which is in this committee's possession now, I believe, and we prefer it to 2726. As you know, we feel a need to have a statewide standard because Multnomah County has passed one, and obviously Lane County, as you've heard, is thinking about it. I would respectfully disagree with Multnomah County's perception of an industry work group because I was not aware of one, and both these people at the table here serve in some capacity on work groups either in Multnomah County or elsewhere, and we're not involved. But I don't think that's neither here nor there, and I would like to commend Representative Kotek. I would actually say she's met with us more down here in a short period of time than Multnomah has over the last year. And I feel that's going very well. Hopefully it will continue. I want to put this in perspective very quickly that people eat out on average about five times a week, which is about a fifth of their meals. When you look at chain restaurants, they tend to make up about a fifth of the population. So when you're talking about labeling, you're talking about a fraction of a fraction. You're talking about a very, very small piece of customers' decision. And these are being asked to do more than anybody else does on a labeling, meaning you have to provide all the information plus you have to market it on the front and center where you don't put the calories on the front of a Cocoa Pebbles box. So you're asking this small percentage to do more than anybody else. The other, I've included polling, and actually it's a summary of the polling, so you have kind of all the gist of the questions, because polling is being thrown around as scientific evidence. We thought we'd throw ours into the mix. But it clearly says people want the information, but I think people tend to be against specific government mandates. So I think there is a want for information, but they, as you get into specifics, it's going to vary from restaurant to restaurant how people want it delivered. And then lastly, I would just make a plea. Our industry is down about 20% this year versus last year, same time. When you look at our industry, we had 2,000 job loss in November, 4,000 job loss in December, another 2,000, I think, is what's going to come out in January's figures in our industry. And so this is a tough time, because there's an expense to gaining this information, and there's a different expense to basically presenting the information and the faction that's being talked about. So both bills do that first step of making sure everybody has it, and all the examples of people saying they couldn't get it or it was complicated, there would be a remedy for that under both bills, meaning you basically would have a recourse of being able to call a DHS or whoever is in charge of saying that I could not get the information adequately. So that problem will be solved under either version of the bill. I've also included a copy of the Federal Lien Act, which was proposed in Washington, D.C., with bipartisan support at the beginning of this week. So I guess my plea is there's no factual data on this is changed behavior. There is some polling, and even the Subway example was one before New York City passed on a voluntary program that Subway did. And that thing Subway does would not meet the requirements of 2726. So there's no factual data at this point that this will have any impact on sales. There is federal pending legislation we're hoping will pass in the next year or so, and business and government revenues are down like they've never been before at this time period. So is really now the time to require posting on menus at the expense? If we've seen...
I'm sorry,
okay,
Bill.
That's fine.
That was fast, two minutes. But you left us printed material. We can look
yes.
at it. Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Chair Tomei.
Good morning.
Committee members. My name is Kevin Bechtel. I'm Senior Vice President of R&D and Menu Development at Sherry's Management Corporation. We have 105 restaurants in the Pacific Northwest, actually operating in six different states, but predominantly in Oregon and Washington, with 80% of them being there. I want to thank you for the opportunity to express our views on the nutritional label policy. Let me begin by saying that Sherry's is in support of the policy conceptually. We are proud to be celebrating our 30th anniversary because we take pride in the fact that we've been listening to our guests and guest needs and requests on issues such as this. We are in support of a statewide or national policy. This is an industry issue. Our guests are requesting the information, and as a service industry, we are naturally driven to provide our guest requests. The issue is how we get the information to our guests consistently and accurately. Currently, Sherry's provides nutritional information as well as ingredient listing for food allergies because our guests have requested the information be available. We receive requests that range from sodium content to the items that are gluten-free, celiac disease. Because of the complexity of the information, we make the information available on our webpage. Guests who understand their dietary needs and issues appreciate the fact that they can make informed decisions about their dining choices. We are currently upgrading our system to make it more interactive. How to best provide that information is a priority to our company, along with the challenge of addressing how to train our staff to utilize the information correctly. As a chain restaurant, while we have more resources to access the information from our vendors and manufacturers and to assimilate the information, there is more time and expense by managing multiple city, county, and state regulations. We currently are printing six different versions of our menu as compared to two before various policies were put into place. Chain restaurants and locations in multiple states are posed with the challenge of presenting the correct information. Limited time promotions that require the requirement to provide nutritional information for menu items should be a minimum of 90 days, not 30 to 90.
Sorry. Do you have written information?
I do.
Great. If you would pass it around, give it to our staff over here, we'll make sure that every person on the committee gets this. Thank you so much for
You're
coming.
Welcome.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to discuss the nutrition disclosure bills, 2726, and also the soon-to-be-introduced that Bill talked about, 2982. I'm Debbie Naginero. I'm a registered dietitian. I'm the Director of Quality Assurance, Nutrition, and Safety for Burgerville. And for maybe some of those who are not in the northern Oregon and southern Washington area, Burgerville's been in business for 45 years. Our corporate office is in Vancouver, Washington. We have, of the 39 restaurants in the chain, 25, soon to be 26 of them, are in the state of Oregon. We have always been very cognizant of what our guests ask of us. As Kevin was talking about, we care very much about what they require of us, and that goes to what our mission is, which is to serve with love. We are we provide nutrition information. We provide ingredient and allergy information. It has always been available longer than I've even been in the company, which has been 10 years. We're in favor of complete nutrition disclosure at point of purchase, but not necessarily on the menu boards. We're in favor of a statewide disclosure of chains of 15 or more, as opposed to various jurisdictions making different rules mandatory in different parts of the state. We're also in favor of the Federal Lean Act that was introduced this week. This will not only help county-to-county mandates, but different state-to-state mandates that affect many chain restaurants besides our own. In Multnomah County, we have 10 restaurants that are affected by Multnomah County's menu disclosure decision for the menu boards, and we're in the process of designing 10 menu boards for 10 new restaurants that will be different than the rest of the companies. This can be very confusing to the guests as they go across county lines and state lines. I also wanted to just bring up a lot of the fine points that Bill will have in the information that he provided you. We are in favor in that one is going from 30 days to 90 days. And the last point I want to make has to do with actually my experience as a registered dietitian and just recently talking to a group of people with diabetes that calories are not what they're taught in following their diet. And a great percentage, obviously, of obese people get type 2 diabetes. They're taught to look at carbohydrates. And so being able to provide information for other disease states, not just the obesity issue that is what has been pushing the menu mandates on the menu boards, I think needs to be taken into consideration also. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And if your information is written, if yes. you give it to staff, that would be terrific. Pardon?
I'll make copies of theirs to
Great.
Make sure everybody gets it.
Any quick questions of anyone on this?
Representative just if I could really Wilson quick, Bill, the Federal Lean Act that's just recently been introduced, what's the difference between that and this House bill we're looking at right now?
Rep. Olson, Chair Tomei, I mean, I do have it included there. I would say it is from 2726. It's pretty dramatically different. There, it does have a preemption as it lists for a national preemption. There are. It does say you have to propose calories, but it gives you about three or four different options to do it as it relates just to calories. But it does have the disclosure of all the main points, which are calories, proteins, carbs, and fats. So I mean, there's some kind of subtle differences, but I would say it's more close to 2982 than it would be 2726.
Thank you.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're kind of rushing today, but
yeah.
I want you to maybe go into the preemption thing a little bit more. I'm in an industry that doesn't have preemption, and we deal with competitive advantages or disadvantages because of the lack of preemption. Could you discuss a little bit of that real quick for us?
Representative Freeman, Chair Tomei. The issue is, I mean, there's obviously, I mean, I'm sitting here with two people that are company-wide stores. They don't have any franchisees, so they have different struggles just because they have to produce different ones. But also, as you get into our industry, I'll say there's two specific type of places. They tend to be Subway and Dairy Queen, tend to be 1-2 person franchisees. And so what it relates to is, even though they can sometimes get the information from their chains, if they have to do menus, menu boards, or other things like that, that pretty much falls on the burden of the franchisee. So as it relates to, I mean, the industry is very diverse. And so to say that just because somebody like McDonald's or Burgerville or Sherry's might be able to meet this, there's a whole bunch of factors as you get into franchise agreements and different types of restaurants that gets a little bit more complex. And when you see what happened in Washington, King County, and New York, they tend to have a stakeholder groups We really haven't had any stakeholder groups look at this in Oregon, and I think that's why there's some of the technical problems in Multnomah County that we see.
Thank you.
Do you think you could ask that? Looks like you have a question. Would you mind?
I have a couple, but I'll hold.
Quick question, really fast.
Well, in terms of the fact that Multnomah County has it, and this is for Bill probably, would not the chain be able to replicate that in other counties?
Rep. Van Orman, Chair Tomei, I mean, it depends on what the issue is. I mean, some of those chains obviously are bigger, and some of them have buying groups statewide. But like I said, every chain and their franchise agreement is different. I mean, Outback is a very distinct type of franchise agreement. Subway is a very distinct type. They're two totally different ones. So you'd have to look at their agreements to find out whether or not those will apply, and it depends on how close. Everything you've done in Multnomah County is nothing like King County. Two separate, completely separate type of ordinances.
But follow-up? But in terms of Oregon, if Multnomah County has determined that this is what it's supposed to look like, mm-hmm. would it not be in the best interest of the chains to replicate that in other counties as a sort of a preemptive strike?
Well, Rep. Van Orman and Chair Tomei, I think what you see in our industry is obviously, they mentioned Noah's Bagels has done this, implemented it since Multnomah County. They did it beforehand. Pizzicato has been looking at this beforehand, and Subway has been doing those things on the plexiglass from before, and I think the industry has been doing a lot of this. They just haven't found anything that actually impacts sales. And that's why, when you look at everything that's being thrown out, it's really pulling data. It's got absolutely nothing to do with sales data.
That's not a question, Bill.
Okay. Okay.
All right. Thanks so much. And I'm sorry to move on, but we have quite a few people who are wanting to speak. Jerry Scott, Susan Connolly, and Mark Watkins.
We've
done six. How many more? Actually, more people.
There's one
there.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead, real fast. You have 2 minutes.
Good morning. My name is Susan Connolly, and I'm the Director of State and Local Government Regulation for Darden Restaurants. Darden is the world's largest company-owned and operated restaurant, full-service restaurant chain with over 1,700 restaurants and 180,000 employees. We own and operate brands such as Red Lobster, Olive Garden, Longhorn Steakhouse, Capital Grill, Bahama Breeze, and Seasons 52. Here in Oregon, we have 12 restaurants, including the Olive Garden in Salem that Representative Kotek referenced earlier in her comments. And we employ about 1,500 people. What I wanted to talk a little bit about today, after listening to the testimony, my comments have changed a little bit. Darden's mission is to nourish and delight everyone we serve. I want to make it abundantly clear we are proud of our food, and we are proud of the millions of meals we serve nationally every day. I represent Darden in all 50 states, excuse me, and have been intimately involved in the debate around menu labeling for the past 2 years. Please allow me a moment to put into perspective some of the things you've heard this morning. Currently, 8 jurisdictions in the United States have passed some form of nutrition disclosure. Of those 8 jurisdictions, only 2, New York City and King County, programs are fully operational. New York City began enforcing their mandate in August of 2008, and King County began enforcement in January 2009. We talk to our guests a lot. It is too early, I can tell you, from all of the research we've done, to evaluate how these laws have affected our business, including guest choice, in what they're ordering every day in our restaurants. All 8 jurisdictions have different requirements, disclosure, exemptions, and enforcement.
15 seconds.
You know, I think that we talked a little bit about preemption earlier in the Lean Act, and I guess what I'd like to close with is, We agree with Representative Kotek and the committee that nutrition disclosure is important. However, by definition, this includes chain restaurants that operate over multi-state borders. We need one national standard so that our guests get the same information in the same way, whether they're eating in Portland, Oregon, or Portland, Maine. And so I would encourage you all to look at one statewide standard or to wait and let us have this opportunity to pass a national standard that will serve our guests in a better capacity. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Go ahead.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Jerry Scott with Elmer's Restaurants out of Portland, Oregon. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to allow me to discuss nutritional disclosure bills. I've given the full written text to be handed out. I'll give you the
Great.
Reader's Digest version. Please let me know when I have 10 seconds left. I'll skip to the last
okay,
paragraph.
Thank you.
We have 24 restaurants operating in four states. 17 of these restaurants are in Oregon. A third of them are operated by the parent company. Two-thirds of those restaurants are operated by franchisees. They're independently and locally owned and operated, and I speak for them as well as for Elmer's Restaurants. We have several issues before us. One of the most important that is to Elmer's, who, by the way, supports nutritional disclosure standards, is a single preemptive statewide standard. There are some other points I'll address, but let me first talk about that. With all the municipalities that we operate in, if each entity were to adopt their own nutritional labeling standards requiring menu posting, we would find ourselves with a dozen new menus every time the smallest of menus changes is made. Most of the cost, and which is significant, of reprinting menus and the design cost would be borne by the individual and local franchisees. With a single statewide standard, this significant expense can be shared by many restaurants, which greatly reduces the shared cost and gives a uniform method of providing the information to the guest. The next item is a legal safe harbor. Now, we've already seen lawsuits in other states attempting to collect damages from restaurant operators who may have unknowingly produced a menu item that had a calorie count different from the official posting. In cases where a restaurant owner has made a good faith effort to evaluate the nutritional information and an honest mistake was made, for instance, a cook put an ounce too much gravy on the mashed potatoes, the owner should not be subject to frivolous and potentially ruinous civil action. Lastly, like most full-service restaurants, Elmer's has menu items that offer many different options.
10 seconds.
Okay, thank you very much. there should be a range of calories allowed in order to allow for those options. We at Elmer's support nutritional disclosure. Says the information needs to be consistent and easy to understand and should not be part of the menu itself. Additionally, a safe harbor and reasonable ranges for combination plates makes sense for both an operator and a guest standpoint. I also urge you to ensure that Oregon's restaurant operators be included in any rulemaking process. Chair to me and members of the committee, thank you for your time. If you
thank
have any questions,
very much.
I'm at your service.
And if you do have written information, please give it to our staff. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and Representative Counts. Nice to see you.
Good morning.
For the record, I'm Mark Watkins, owner of a Subway franchise in Newport, Oregon, since 1991. As an independent franchisee, I have some specific issues about HB 2726. Let me make myself very clear. I understand the importance of providing my customers nutritional data in my store, and I take that role very seriously. Subway Corporate provides me with all kinds of nutritional data, and I have that available posted in my lobby, on my counter, and in the plexiglass counter in front of the customers at all times. However, when it comes to mandatory specific data menu labeling, I have two major concerns. Number one, I believe that it will not have an influence overall on my customers' choices. A few years back, Subway had a very successful marketing campaign based around an individual named Jared Fogel. I'm sure you've all heard. He lost over 185 pounds by moderately exercising and eating two different sandwiches that had less than 6 grams of fat. That campaign increased the sales of all Subways dramatically. And by the way, I appreciate all the positive comments that's been mentioned about Subway. everybody knows about Jared Vogel, and it was a very successful campaign. I was in the store. I worked in my stores about approximately 65 hours a week. That campaign increased my sales, and it was a wonderful program. However, it was only out of curiosity did those customers want to know what Jared ate. They typically did not vary from ordering their favorite and unusual sandwiches. For the last 8 years, because we're franchised, we are mandated by the franchise to have nutritional information and caloric intake data posted at the point of sale. And I have heard several customers comment on a chart or want more additional information. But once again, it did not change the percentage of sales on any given menu item in that store for that individual customer. Some people like BMT, they're going to eat BMT. If this law is passed in Oregon, the cost of changing the menu boards will fall on me, the franchisee. If the law is done nationally, the cost will be added to each individual franchisee agreement. I'm not a large corporation. I'm an independent business person who provides 16 good jobs in my community, and I'm considered a chain restaurant. I am struggling with my budget in the same way that you are struggling with yours. I could go through a list of increases, like mandatory minimum wage increases resulting in higher payroll taxes, corporate taxes, personal property taxes, increased health insurance fees, food costs, utilities, and so on, but I'm going to spare you the time.
We'd be happy to look at this material. Thank you so much.
This would be This would be one
I'm
addition.
I'm closing you off.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I appreciate your time. I will answer any questions.
Representative Cowan.
Madam Chair, thank you, because this is a question I had previously, but Mark's the one I want to ask it.
Yes, ma'am.
First of all, I was very pleased when I saw the slideshow this morning that my choice of sandwiches is the lowest calorie one on the menu.
Bravo.
Thank heavens. But I heard testimony somewhere along the way that Subway, what Subway does wouldn't meet the requirements of this bill. And if I'm, and when I looked at the slideshow, it seemed like it would meet it very well. Is the confusion because of what the nutritional information you have out now and it's not on the menu board? Is that why I'm confused about that?
I'm confused, too. I have no idea. I've heard about it in Subway snippets in our email, corporate email, what they're doing in New York. But it's too early to tell if that caloric intake is posted at the point of sale, if it's going to change anybody's mind.
Oh, I understand the part about changing minds, and that's, I don't think, the goal so much. It is personal choice. But we'll work it out then in the work sessions as to whether what you're doing meets the requirements, because that's a confusion I have.
Great. Maybe if you could communicate with him offline and find out that information and share it with the committee, that would be terrific. Thank you so much for coming.
You're welcome.
Representative Maurer.
Two quick questions. Number one, how much does the menu cost? Just ballpark. You know, the paper menu or the plastic cover. Second question is, how much does a menu board cost? I have no clue.
Good point. And well, maybe you can get that information. Can you get that information to us?
These approximate on a full service menu. I can't comment to menu board. The full service restaurant menu like ours, it has over 100 items on there. Even something as similar as calorie counts. When you have to redesign the menu to allow for any changes or putting the counts on there, including substantial artwork and a lot of pages that are done well, it'd be about $10,000 per restaurant.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
About $10,000 per restaurant.
Every time?
Every time we repaint it. That's a multi-page menu, and they're very expensive to design and print.
The design work, I will tell you from our perspective, redesigning for every local jurisdiction is where we get the most of our cost. Putting calories, you know, again, it's our biggest marketing tool. So we're not going to just put out a piece of paper with a bunch of numbers on it. So we spend a lot of time, energy, and effort making sure our guests get the information that we're required to present in the format that they're used to seeing. So the design part for us, not the printing part, is what takes an exorbitant amount of our time.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but we need to move on. And
budget.
So we'd like to have this information. If you will get this to us, that would be terrific. We'd like to have it.
Can I just ask one just very, very simple?
Fast.
Jerry, how many restaurants did you say Elmer's have?
We have a total of 24 restaurants in the chain, and 17 of those are in Oregon.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you so much for coming today. Really appreciate it. So we have Mary Lou Henrich. Rachel Bourbonis and Kat Livingston.
Oh, that's right.
Some of the people are going to be, I think one has already left. People will be leaving because normally we end at 10, but we've got quite a few. Actually, it was more than 11. So we're going to stay as long as we can, but we're going to keep
great.
It at 2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Raquel Bornanesque, and I'm with Upstream Public Health. I'd like to address a few issues that came up today. You heard from both sides, from the Restaurant Association and also from the restaurants that they support, and also from the consumer groups and health groups. And what you heard is that both groups really approve of giving consumers nutrition information. But the remaining question is, how can we best provide this information to consumers? So I'd like to give you a summary of a study that was done last year that I have copies of for you. On the most effective way to communicate nutrition information to consumers, the researchers surveyed over 7,000 restaurant customers and asked whether the customer saw the information. And the study was done with some restaurants posting calories on menu boards, and other restaurants had this information in alternative formats such as posters and brochures. The conclusion that posting calories at the point of decision making is 8 times more effective compared to alternative formats. And I have copies of this study for you all. I'd also like to stand by the polling that was done. This poll was conducted by Davis, Hibbets, and McGall, which is an independent opinion research firm, nonpartisan, that showed that two-thirds of Oregonians want the nutrition information. And when we actually pulled out the data of the Portland metro area and of the whole Willamette Valley, still two-thirds of Oregonians support menu labeling on menu boards. We heard a bit today about reformulation. One point I wanted to make is that reformulation is the market system at work. For example, if there's a business that has salads and pizzas, if they have calorie shock once they do their number crunching and they see that their salads actually have more calories than their pizzas, businesses want to reformulate so that maybe they cut down on some of the ingredients in the ranch dressing. But this is good business practice, and it's
We're
good business
sense. We're going to ask you to wrap up.
Okay, sure. The last issue I wanted to bring up is the federal legislation. At the Multnomah County hearings, the Restaurant Association basically said, no, we just need to do this at the state level. And now that we're at the state, they say, let's leave this up to the federal legislation. Oregon polls show that Oregonians want this. And we are in good touch with our folks at the national level doing advocacy work. And it appears that even though there's something proposed, that really there isn't the political will. This is not a priority for Congress at this time. Thank you.
And Raquel, if you could give us that printed information, that would be terrific.
Sure.
Mary Lou.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, thank you. I'm Mary Lou Henrich. I am the Executive Director of Community Health Partnership, Oregon's Public Health Institute. I appreciate, and I'm just going to try to quickly go over a few things that I think might have been a little confusing. One is the when Commissioner Kogan talked in Multnomah County about the process, and I was involved in the process, and Debbie Nagy Nero, Kara Fallon, who works with Bill Perry, were involved. They're on the Food Service Advisory Board in Multnomah County, and that was one of the first places that this issue was brought up. So there were representatives and others from the restaurant industry who were there every step of the way. Difference of opinions, maybe on how it ended up, but the fact is there was a long, and from the advocate's point of view, rather laborious, and sometimes felt like, geez, can't we get on with this? But there was, and I'm going to ask Sonia Manhouse, who directed the all of that, to, she's out of town in Hawaii this week, but she will write to you and explain the various meetings and who attended, and because there was a extensive process, and I just wanted to clarify that. I also think that the issue on costs, that we aren't denying that there are some costs. What we're saying is, though, that out of the 181 chains in Oregon, 132 of them are caught under the Multnomah County net. They are going to have to do this. So the ones that are not under the Multnomah County net, the other 40-some, 21 of those have restaurants in New York City or in Seattle that do require posting on the menu board. So there will be that redesign piece done. So it leaves about 20 that aren't covered under one of those places. And there are organizations like the Oregon Dietetic Association and 15%. Us that are willing to help on the nutritional analysis, and it really is not a significant number.
Thank you so much, Mary Lou. And if you can get any of that in writing to us, that would be great. Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, I am Dr. Kat Livingston. I'm a family physician, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Public Health Association. As you know, obesity is an epidemic. It causes cancer, heart disease, diabetes, premature death, and other diseases. One key issue is the overconsumption of calories. The problem is that people just don't know how many calories are in different types of food. As a family physician, I can't accurately estimate. Dietitians cannot accurately estimate how many calories are in food. This House Bill 2726 provides a very simple, clear, and effective way to allow people to know what they're eating and to make a choice or not make a choice based on that information. As a primary care physician, I talk to my patients often about their weight, about how to eat, and they'll come into my office all the time and they'll say, "Doctor, I just don't understand. I'm doing what you said. I'm only eating red meat once a week. I'm only eating fried foods once a week. I'm eating fish and chicken, but I'm still gaining weight. I don't understand." And this is where calorie information is really important. This is where this bill could make a difference for those people who are trying to make a difference in the food that they're eating. Many academic and leading organizations support menu labeling. The American Medical Association, the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, the Food and Drug Administration, the Surgeon General, the Institute of Medicine, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the National Cancer Institute, among others. This is good public health policy. This policy empowers Oregonians to make informed choices. I and the Oregon Public Health Association strongly urge you to endorse this bill, to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Livingston. And would you make sure that we have a copy of your written information? Thank you.
We do.
We do. Great. Oh, thanks. Good. Thank you so much. Thank you for coming.
You.
So Elise Brown, Matt Wallace. Let's see who else. Alejandro. Elise, are you bringing somebody named Alejandro with you? Okay, we just have a few more after this. Go ahead, please.
Sure. I guess I'll start. For the record, my name is Matt Wallace. I'm a consumer advocate with OSPRC, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. We're a statewide, citizens-based public interest advocacy organization here in Oregon. And I'll try to make just 3 points in the next 90 seconds.
Great.
They are this. We wanted to say thanks again for the opportunity. Well, that's not one of the points. Thank you for the opportunity to weigh in support of House Bill 2726. The first point is that it really is a consumer right-to-know issue, not a mandating food choice issue. For myself, I can say my tastes tend towards the American culinary tradition that brought us the fried pickle. But I know that I want to know, the kinds of choices that I'm making and have the information that's going to help me make that choice. If the side effect of that is that, restaurants reformulate healthier choices, we think that's a good thing, too. The second point is that having that information on the menu is incredibly important. And I think the quick analogy is we're all very familiar with food packaging laws that have been around for years and years and years. And if that information isn't available at the point of purchase, it would be similar to having to go up to the checkout stand and ask the calorie counts for the two kinds of cereal you're looking at in the cereal aisle or go look at a poster near the bathrooms there. So you need to actually have that information there at the point of sale. We think that's very, very important. And the third point I wanted to make is that just as a general principle, wider-reaching regulation should almost always be a floor and not a ceiling. So we want to make sure that the local levels of governments have the opportunity to innovate, to go forward. And we think that's true whether you're comparing state and federal law on a wide variety of consumer protection issues or whether that's local versus state law. And I think I'd point out that if, we'd had sort of a level of preemption against menu labeling here at the state level on the status quo as it is today, we may not be having this conversation thanks to the actual forward-thinking efforts of Multnomah County that helped to sort of bring this conversation forward to us here. So we think that's a very important piece as well. And I will leave it there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Elise?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, Elise Brown, representing American Diabetes Association, Oregon chapter. And not to repeat all the great information before, certainly here to tell you that American Diabetes Association of Oregon is very supportive of this bill. One of the things that I wanted to remind this legislative body, particularly our newcomers to the legislature this year, that last session this body passed House Bill 3486, which charged the legislature with coming up, created actually a diabetes task force. So this is the next great first step advancing the goals of that task force. And one important thing that everybody should keep in mind and keep in perspective is the cost to the state for diabetes complications. And the number for 2006 is over $2 billion. So that's a 2006 amount that we know has escalated since then. So for that reason, our organization is very supportive of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Alejandro, go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Alejandro Corral. I'm State Director of Government Affairs for the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association. Thank you so much for holding this hearing. The American Heart Association strongly supports HB 2726 because it provides consumers with the information they need at the point of purchase, caloric information. HB 2726 also will provide, upon consumer request, information on sodium content, total fats, saturated fats, and carbohydrates. So it's much more complete than just providing the calories. But as you've heard today, the caloric information is particularly important in determining weight management and dieting. I also want to point out that the percent of food consumed away from home has increased tremendously over the last decades. In 1978, 18% of the food consumed away from home, 18% of the food was consumed away from home. As of 1996, 32% of all foods was consumed away from home. And 46% of our food budget of the average American is spent on eating out. So there is a significant amount of people, there are a significant amount of people that are going out to eat on a regular basis. Now, consumer behavior has been affected by the Nutrition Labeling and Education Act of 1990. We know that about 70 to 85% of the public reads nutrition labels, and those that read those nutrition labels tend to have diets that are lower in fat and calorie content, and higher in fruit and vegetable consumption. But restaurants, as you know, are exempt from this law, and this is why it's so important to bring them up to the same standards. Finally, studies have shown that people that consume, eat out regularly at fast food restaurants tend to consume about 205 more calories per day than those don't eat out. That adds up to about 20 extra pounds a year. And that, of course, brings increased risk for type 2 diabetes, hypercholesterolemia, and related cardiovascular diseases. So it is increasingly important, and as we know, the obesity epidemic is costing Oregonians $780 million a year, so it's increasingly important that we provide consumers with the information they need so they can make more healthful choices. Finally, I want to point out one key difference between the HB 2726 and the Restaurant Association's proposed bill, and this is key because what the Restaurant Association has put forth, it would actually allow so much variability from one restaurant to the next. So you could have one McDonald's in one place providing the consumer information in the back of the bathroom in a poster, and another McDonald's just a couple of miles down the road providing the same information on brochures. So if we're going to allow consumers to know how and what to expect when they go into restaurants, we should all have, all the restaurants should have the same standards in terms of how this information is provided. So I strongly urge you to vote in favor of HB 2726, and thank you again for holding this hearing. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, and thanks for presenting us with written information, too. That's very helpful. Thank you. Alex Coulier and Adriana Van Voss. I'm not sure how to pronounce that last name. And was there anybody? Oh, Ted Farthing? And I think that's all we have signed up to talk with us today. Is there anybody else who has a burning need to speak to us? Good. Okay. Go ahead.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Manager for Lane County. I did want to make a couple quick points with regards to Lane County's position on this bill. We do support the bill. It has been through our legislative committee, and the Board of County Commissioners does like it. They are aware of the Restaurant Association's bill. The key points...
One moment, please. I'm sorry. We've lost quorum, so we need to close our actual meeting and open at the subcommittee meeting.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. So I'm closing the public hearing on, what is the bill, 2726, and opening up a subcommittee, right?
Yes.
Subcommittee hearing on 2726.
So, thank you.
Sorry about that.
And we're still here.
The points that we wanted to emphasize that we're particularly concerned that you maintain the position of the point of decision making with regards to the caloric information, either on a menu board or on a menu. We're also concerned about, and most counties are, about preemption issues, rather not to see preemption. I think there is some further discussion going on about the number of restaurants in a chain that would then trigger this, and we're hopeful that those discussions remain fruitful. I also wanted to let the committee know that Lane County, the Board of County Commissioners, is taking this up as a local issue within the next several weeks, and has been very interested in the concept of a local ordinance with regards to menu labeling, and it may be something that well does come out of the Lane County later this year.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ted Farthing, Executive Director of the Oregon Wine Growers Association. To date, California is the only state to adopt a statewide requirement regarding menu labeling. California's law clearly exempts alcoholic beverages. And we believe this is the best approach, given that the focus of menu labeling proposals are to educate consumers regarding the nutritional value of standard food items sold in chain restaurants. Alternatively, all local jurisdictions that have adopted requirements to provide such information clearly permitted the use of the typical values from the USDA database. We worked with Multnomah County to incorporate clear disclosure regarding alcoholic beverages using the information from this database. Basically, it's serving size, calorie, carbohydrate, and sodium content for wine, regular beer, light beer, and distilled spirits. And unlike most food groups, as eloquently illustrated in the slideshow, these values tend to be almost the same within each of these categories. I might also point out that wine doesn't have any trans fats. Wineries are not currently required to analyze their products for caloric or other nutritional information, and such testing has not been a part of standard industry practice. Since this information is not readily available, providing it for menu purposes places an undue burden on wineries, especially smaller ones. Exemption of alcoholic beverages or clearly providing for use of the USDA typical values would prevent wineries from having to test each vintage of every wine on a label at a cost of over $500 per product. Requiring this costly analysis could keep wines produced by small wineries in Oregon and others outside off wine lists. And right now, many of our wineries are struggling for survival. The Oregon Wine Growers Association urges you to clarify the language regarding alcoholic beverages in this bill to preferably exempt these beverages or, in the alternative, incorporate the clear disclosure adopted by Multnomah County. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming to testify. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Adriana Vosandre, and I'm a parent and resident of Multnomah County. I've been visiting my neighborhood bagel store that recently started putting calories on their menu boards. And I just want to say, I think it's such a great idea. I have three little kids, and when I go out to eat, when I take them out to eat, I don't have the time to go hunting for where the calories are posted or ask my hungry kids to please wait while I look through complicated tables and try and calculate calorie counts. It's just impossible. Having the calories right there next to the price where I'm making my decision is such a simple and practical idea. It gives me the freedom to make make the healthier choice for my family. And you know, I would prefer taking my family to a restaurant that is honest and upfront about what it's putting into our food and gives me the choice as a parent. Also, if you're a busy mom and you occasionally take your kids to the drive-thru, I think it's important to have the calories posted there in the same way as well. As a consumer and as a parent, I feel it's my right to know what I'm putting into my body and to know what I'm putting into my children's bodies. This is about consumers' rights. And this is why I recently testified at my county hearing and was very grateful that my commissioners unanimously voted to give me and all their constituents this basic right. But I took the time off again to come here today because I'm also an Oregonian, and I feel strongly that all Oregonians, just as all moms and dads, deserve this same right. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming to testify today. Thank you very much. So that's all we have who have signed up to testify. What I do here sometimes when there are people in the audience who might be supportive or opposed to a bill is ask you to stand up and just tell us if you support or oppose and just give us your name and maybe where you're from. Is anybody willing to do that? So whoever is supportive, just...
I support. I'm Sarah Grove from Oregon.
Thank you.
And I'm Nancy Becker from the Oregon Nutrition Policy Alliance, and I'm very much supportive.
Great. Anyone else? Anyone on this? Thank you, Jane. All right. Anybody else who wants to stand? And
yeah, Mel Rader from Portland, Oregon, supporting this.
Thank you.
Leslie Halbrand, Portland, Oregon, supporting too.
Great. Anyone else who hasn't had a chance? Okay, anybody who's opposed to it who would like us to know that? Okay, thank you all for coming today.
Yeah, sure. Yes. Yeah, I just want to share something here and place it on record here. I realize just about everybody else is gone here on our committee, but the study that was conducted in New York City in 07, it was conducted over a 10-week period of time. Now, I have a degree in methodology. This is absolutely an atrocious research project that was done back then. And my reasoning behind that is the description for the sampling strategy and the data collection was driven on a biased manner. And why I say that is because the research itself ends up indicating in here that the folks that were doing the research offered a $2 MetroCard to anyone who is over age 18 who would participate in the study. It does not also identify of the 167 random restaurants that were interviewed or solicited, how many of the patrons could have very easily been duplicated. So, I mean, I understand where they're wanting to go, but this research project itself has a lot of fallacy to it.
Which one is it?
This is the one from New York City.
Oh, this one that says study at the top?
Yes.
Thank you.
I mean, I understand what parents and restaurant people are saying here today, but this study here I really struggle with.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Okay. I will close the subcommittee on House Bill 2726 and close the hearing on public hearing 2726 and close the committee on human services. Thank you all.